Good day, everyone. Welcome to the CS Horticultural Relentless Gardener podcast. I am Colorado State University horticulture specialist Linda Langelo, and joining me today is Jan Johnson, who has been in horticulture and landscaping for more than 40 years and owns her own business in New York, Johnson Landscapes and Pools. Her work has been featured in numerous publications, including This Old House and Horticulture, and she is a contributing editor to Garden Design. Now let's get to the heart of it, where we explore the horticultural topic of her book, Gardentopia, Design Basics for Creating Beautiful Outdoor Spaces. Hello, Jan. I'm so glad you could join me today.
Hello, Linda. I am thrilled to be here with you.
I'm excited about this. Design is one of a favorite topic of mine. And I need to ask you to start right off, what was the age that you got interested in plants?
Well, that's a great question because, you know, I don't know where all your listeners are, but I actually grew up in little tiny apartments in New York City. And so there I was as a child, surrounded by, you know, concrete sidewalks. But I told my mother when I was like 7 or 8 that I wanted to grow corn. I'd seen corn growing, and I wanted to grow corn on the windowsill, you know. And she thought that was hysterical, but she didn't stop me. And then as I got older, you know, I would grow little tomato plants on the fire escape in these big tomato sauce cans. I was, if anybody was tuned in, they would have seen, oh, this kid likes plants, you know?
Right.
But my parents were both artists. So I had a big art background growing up in New York City, but I love plants, you know? And so I have a great story to tell you about how I kind of tuned into plants a little bit deeper. Can I share it with you?
Oh, go right ahead. I'm right up there with you, I'm sure.
Oh, thank you. So I went to a public school high school called High School of Music and Art. It was in New York City.
Wow.
And you had to, you know, get in there. But it was great. You know, it's for artists and these great musicians, you know, art. And so, but one day, my biology teacher, I was in junior year of high school, said to me, "You're very good in biology. I want you to join the New York City Science Fair." And I said, "Well, no, I'm an artist, you know, 16. I'm an artist." And she said, "No, but you're one of the best biology students. You have to join the New York City Science Fair." And I said, "Well, I don't know what to do." She said, "Come back to me in a week with an experiment." And so I come back in a week and I say, "I have the experiment." And she said, "What is it?" Now, you have to understand, this is late 1960s, because you might know what I'm going to talk about now, but in the 60s, for those who don't realize it, we were not into plants. Horticulture was not even known. You know what I'm saying?
Right,
I mean,
right.
There's just no connection whatsoever, especially in an urban environment.
Really?
I come back to her and I say, I want to experiment on the effective sound on the growth of plants.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh.
In 1967 or 68.
And today.
And she says, and she went hysterical laughing. She thought it was the most absurd thing she had ever heard. And I really, you know, I was not like all into this idea of this project. She takes me into the teacher's lounge. I'm 16, right? And she says, "Tell them what your experiment is," because it was so absurd. Well, I, being 16 years old, was mortified, right? Totally mortified.
Of course.
But it was the best thing my teacher ever did for me, because I walked out of there and I said, "I'm going to show her," right?
Right. Yes, right. Exactly. And today, entomologists in the Journal of Entomology are doing lab experiments to attract spotted lanternflies, which is an invasive pest, and it is in Kansas waiting to knock on our door in Colorado. And they have been playing around with vibrational frequency. And
There,
so
see that?
they raised the vibration to 60 hertz. And guess what? They
What?
attracted those lanternfly like absolutely a click of a finger. And
Oh my goodness. This is
they,
what that I did not know. I'm gonna look that one up. Boy, that is.
yes. And they said, maybe we can do this without chemicals. Maybe we can look at this differently. Acoustic signals, right?
Okay, so let me get to the end of the story, because then
Okay.
once I do, you can take off with this. You know more about this than I do, obviously. But this is like we're talking, you know, how 50 years ago? I don't know. No, not quite 50 years, but definitely decades ago. And so I go home. Now I live in an apartment with my father, and I'm like, I can't play the radio to the plants growing on my windowsill because, you know, it would keep us up at night, you know. So what I did was, and it was with coleus plants in the same conditions, and I put a clock on a little box right next to my plant going tick, tick, and I had someone else do it in their apartment as my, you know, and I did it somewhere else. Anyway, I come to New York City Science Fair, and with my plants, everybody else has these magnificent displays. I didn't realize that this was a massive thing. This is New York City, you know, Bronx High School of Science. I mean, this was big, big stuff. I had taken my little box on the city bus by myself to go there. I mean, my teacher was just like, she was not proud of my display, but I explained to the judges and I said to them, and this is important, I said to the judges, well, they've done experiments in India and they have found, this 16-year-old girl here talking, and they found that sitar music and violin music have the best effect on the growth. And indeed, my plant had grown 3 times faster than the control plant. Long story short, first place in New York City Science Fair.
Yay, good for you.
Now, here's the kicker, which you're gonna love. So that's great. I go home, I tell my dad, hey, I won, you know, go out for Chinese food, whatever, you know. And then, like several decades later, I'm sitting in my house and I'm reading an article, and they say bird song, which has the same megahertz as violin music, and it clicked in my head, and I went, oh my God. The bird song makes the plants grow. And now, of course, people know that. But
Right.
and what I had surmised as a teenager was that the vibrations made the cytoplasm move faster. That was my, you know, my what I told the judges. I had no clue. What it really is that the vibrations, maybe, you know, this open up the stomata, the pores on the underside of the leaf, which
Yes.
enhances
Yes.
additional absorption
Yes.
of right,
And
the
their
oxygen.
bird song can change every day. And they harmonize the environment and shift the energy around. All animals do. I have a cat story about taking energy, toxic energy away from a dear friend of mine. And it was over her heart chakra. And he always wanted to go outside right after that, and I'd watch him shake it all off, and there was a toxic orange brown energy that would float off of him every time. And
But the cat would do that as a.
yes, and Sparky, and he's still alive today. She isn't. She just recently died of aorta stenosis. 14 years. That's 14 years prior. Now, they shift energy. They are tuned in.
So I have to appreciate my cat a little bit more, right?
Well, I
I'm
guess.
gonna thank my cat when I see her.
So, but you know, and we could talk about this for ages, but
I mean, basically, it is all about energy, which we're finally, you know, the greater public is understanding, I think, right?
right. Well, I mean, you know, it's Einstein's premise that all energy is created, nothing's destroyed, it just transforms. I mean, they get that when you talk about a block of ice that melts into water, that evaporates into the air, and each one of those has their own frequency, right? So, and you and I cycle up and down. Every cell in our body is vibrating at a particular level, and it's the totality of all of that. And our words are important because there are acoustic signals, you know. Our thoughts are acoustic signals. Plants have acoustic signals between each other, between animals, and so forth. And there's so much more to that. I mean, that's just the icing on the cake, so to speak.
Boy, yeah, you and I are definitely on the same wavelength, you know?
Yeah.
But I thought you would enjoy that story.
Thank you for that. But your book, Gardentopia, what
Yes.
inspired you to write this book for people?
Okay, so what happened is that in the course of my life, I ended up becoming a studying landscape architecture. And I got into studying landscape architecture as a college student. I had full scholarship. And I went to Japan. Oh, because my guidance counselor in the city said, "Oh, you like art and you like plants, you should become a botanical illustrator." And I said, "No, I'm thinking of maybe being an architect." At that point, she should have said landscape architect. But back then, nobody even knew that was a profession, honest to God. So I had no direction in that. It's so stupid. So when I'm being an intern in an architecture office in Osaka, Japan, and in the weekends I would go to visit the Japanese gardens in Kyoto, the legendary Japanese gardens. And I would go in these gardens, Linda, and the stress would just drop off of me, and I would be transported to this green world of just I can't even express how spectacular it was. Was for me because it said, and long story short, I started in my project in my I was designing a museum for the client. I put the building in the side of the hill, which was never done back then. That was totally unusual. And I started designing the bridge and the path and the trees. And my sensei, my teacher, my boss said to me in Japanese, "You're not an architect, you're a landscape architect." And he sent me off to a landscape architecture office in Osaka. And that's when I realized that's what I'm supposed to do for a
Oh,
living.
wow.
And so I came back home to New York. It was totally adrift because where am I? What's going on here? And I moved to Hawaii and I lived on an organic farm and studied landscape architecture in Hawaii, just so you understand. And so my whole career has been trying to recreate for my clients the feeling I had when I walked through those Japanese gardens. And I've taught at Columbia University for 7 years. I still teach at New York Botanic Gardens. And what happened, and this is how the book came about, my students would say to me, regarding landscape design, they knew all the names of all the plants, and then but they would say to me, "What are the rules? What are the rules for designing?" And I would say to them, "There are no rules." And da, 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 da. But I would go on my job sites, my landscape projects, and doing something. And I said to myself, "Well, that could be a rule." But I hate that word, of course, so I'm sure you understand. And so I said, "Well, that's a design basic. That's a design tip." And so I started for my students putting together these design tips and showing the PowerPoint of, well, the curve, we could talk, we'll talk about that. But, and so that's how it came about, Linda, was I was teaching my students these design tips and I started to amass a lot of them.
Wow.
And I
Well,
put them all together to make the book Gardentopia.
yeah, and you have five beautiful sections where you start out with those garden design and artful accents, and then go on to walls, patios, walks, and steps, and then theme garden. color in
Yeah.
the garden, and
It's
plants
quite a
and
bit.
planting.
135 tips. I mean, I,
Yes, and
yeah.
they're amazing. And
Thank you. Thank you.
in your design section, you introduce, which I love this, the idea of hide and reveal. Can you explain it
Also,
to the listening audience?
yes, and that of course comes from living in Japan
Right.
because I have a tiny little property, and in Japan they have tiny little outdoor spaces. And so, in order to make a space feel larger or more interesting, what you do is you don't show off the entire view of your back yard or your whatever. You create like a little something that blocks the entire view. It could be a shrub, it could be a sculpture, it could be a big pot with flowers, but it doesn't, so you can't see everything all at one fell swoop, hide and reveal. And then it invites you to explore further, like go around this big pot with geraniums and see what's on the other side.
Right.
Yeah, does that
I
make
think
sense?
yeah, it's wonderful.
Thank
So
you.
my favorite tips from that section, garden design, were respect the genius of the place, and
Ah.
gardens are a mirror of myself. How many times and how many people have come from, like, Pennsylvania and come out to Colorado and said, well, I want to have these plants, or California, and they want to have a bird of paradise outside growing in their area. Well, that's not what we're about here. We can't sustain that. So that is not the respect of the genius of the place, right?
That's so true. That is so true. And that comes from that famous quote by Alexander Pope, right? About
Right.
the genius of the place.
Right.
And it's a very famous quote. What page is that on? Because I'm going to I'm not sure where it is. Like I said, when you have 135 illustrated tips, it's a little hard to find that.
It's page, no, that's hide and reveal. Oh, here it is, 12. So Alexander Pope,
Yep.
the epistle to Lord Burlington, to build, to plant, whatever you intend, to rear the column or arch to bend, to swell the terrace or to sink the grot, in all let nature never be forgot. Consult the genius of the place in all.
Yes. And you know what's interesting about that is I once had an interview with a very famous garden writer, and he said, yes, everybody uses that quote. How do you how do you define the genius of the place? And I was kind of put on the spot. You know, how do I define the genius of the place? You know, I could use a lot of big words and stuff, but that's not wouldn't make my point. So I said, well, I'll tell you what. I said, the way you do it is you take your shoes off and you go outside and you walk on the ground, and that is how you kind of find the genius of the place. He didn't know what to say. He was like, what?
I'll bet not, because I tell people, if you want to connect, take your shoes off, walk along the grass, and feel the energy. Because I tell people, I've gone out in fields, different fields, and every field has a different energy. And I've even stood in some ditches, and I said, there's some ditches I don't want to stand in, and I'd get in and go right out of them. And there's other ditches. Oh wow, what a cool feeling! I mean, I don't, it may sound nuts, but
Not to
it's
me.
the energy of that play. It's just like you going shopping or something, and you go with a friend, and your friend says, let's go in this shop, and you go, no, I don't want to go there, right? I mean, it's that same deal. Or, oh, I'm not going in that restaurant, that doesn't feel right to me. It's our
Exactly
intuition.
right.
It's our intuition. We're so connected,
And that is why in this book, you know what I'm trying to do, I'm trying to show people, and it's kind of difficult how to create an outdoor space of any size that makes you feel good. What is it that's what was it about those Japanese gardens that made me feel so good? So one of the tips that I share that goes back to our ancestors is called the lure of the sheltered corner.
Oh, wow.
And what it is, and this is very good for a designer or anybody, doesn't have to be anybody who has a garden. Say you have a bench you want to place somewhere, or we all love to have our backs protected with a view out to the front. It's kind of like when you go to a restaurant and you, where do you want to sit? Same table in the corner kind of deal.
Right.
Same idea here. Where do you want to sit? And so the back protected could be some trees, a hedge, a wall. It could even be at the base of a slope. The slope could be your protection, or a building, of course. The lure of the sheltered corner, and then you have to have a little bit of a view, no matter what. But I'm rather than nobody wants to sit on the bench in the middle of the lawn, right? You
Right.
want the sheltered corner, and
Right.
that goes back to our ancestors. And so that's like a one of the tips that I share, you know, to make a place feel wonderful. Another one. Do you mind if I tell you a few more
Oh,
of the
please
tips?
go ahead, please.
So another one I have, and I'm just, you know, opening it up, the book here was called Yin and Yang in the Garden.
I love that. Not many people understand that, but go ahead. Yeah.
Well, no, okay, well, please feel free. I refer back to the traditional Chinese gardens, which really were into yin and yang, male, female, bright and dark, wet and dry. You know, it's always the opposites. And it's contrast, basically, the contrast of the two. And so an outdoor space, a garden of any kind with plant material is, you know, this is so true for plant material, is that it's about, you know, big leaves with little leaves, or hard rock with soft foliage, you know, fern foliage next to it, or it's just about yin and yang. And you know, where rocks very hard, they symbolize the timelessness and enduring, you know, of an element next to an ephemeral little flower. But it makes the contrast is what makes it so compelling.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I just love that. I also like the long view
Oh, yeah.
in a garden where you talk about the narrow path and how in a small space that makes that garden seem larger.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, and a long view. I mean, like, again, I have a very small backyard, very small. But so I take that long, like the diagonal across my little space, and I put something at that far end because that will pull your eye out to the far end. So, and like you said, if you have a narrow, say you have a narrow walkway, or narrowness makes everything feel longer. So if that's what you want. Now, the opposite is true too. Let's say you're talking about narrow and wide. If you have a slight slope, and if you put in a 3 foot wide stairs going up, it will make the slope seem much higher than it is. So what I do, and I illustrate this in the book, where I did these long grass steps, very long, wide ones, and then the treads are turf. It could be treads, could be gravel, by the way. It doesn't have to be turf. I try to explain. It doesn't have to be grass. It could be gravel steps, but very long, then it minimizes the feeling of the height. It's all about scale and proportion, and I talk about that.
Yeah, you do. I love the idea too of move the furniture.
Oh, yes.
Why
Wasn't
does
fun.
it have to be in one place all the time?
They did an experiment. This guy named William White did an experiment back in the 60s. This was in the city in New York, where he watched where people would sit. And they preferred to sit on chairs that were not in a park, that were not fixed in the ground. Not that they would necessarily move them, but they liked the idea that they could move them. It was just the idea that you were in charge.
Right.
That's what he said.
Right.
And so now parks, it or parks in urban areas are now consciously putting in lightweight, movable furniture. furniture rather than these heavy duty benches.
Oh, that's so cool. You know, I've worked on a couple of college campuses, and the architects come in and they lay out the walks and everything. Well, why don't you wait until the first semester of class starts and then lay out the walks, because it's hard on the grounds crew if you have to reseed the grass that they keep walking on because they don't like where you put the
Did
walks.
you did they did anybody listen to you?
No.
You know that I'm so glad you brought that up. There's a very famous historic figure in landscape architecture, the first woman landscape architect, but she didn't like that term. She called herself the landscape gardener, which I like too. Her name was Beatrix Ferran, and this was like in the early 1900s, and Princeton hired her to lay out the grounds. And she just did just what you said.
Wow.
She followed what where the students walked, and that was the she was smart, just like you. She, yeah,
Why
nobody.
waste the expense and the time and just human nature, follow human nature, what it's going to do, and that's the best garden. I mean, that's what I think.
That is such a good point. That's such a good point.
Yeah.
I guess that follows your whole understanding that we're working in tandem, or we're co-creating with nature rather than
Absolutely. Yeah.
imposing ourselves on it.
Well, that's, to me, that's always been the way it's intended to be,
Yeah,
right?
I totally agree with you. Which is I when I was studying landscape architecture, I applied to Harvard, and I saw what they were doing. They gave me the tour of what they were doing in their studios and everything. And then I said, well, thank you very much. And then they called and asked me if I would please apply to join for that year. And I basically said, I don't like what you're teaching, and I was saying no to Harvard, but I just felt like I wasn't That wasn't where I was going, because those are the people that you're describing come in and just lay the lines down the way they choose, not the way people use them.
And that's where they are. And you have to respect that. That's where they are.
That's where they are. You're
Yeah.
absolutely right, Linda. That's where they are.
And I love the idea of your circular space, because I don't know a lot of gardeners who consider circular space. I don't know whether they're afraid of it or they think it's not going to be the right proportion or they got the wrong garden for that. But explain that to people.
Well, I have a whole thing in one of my other books, by the way, about shape in the garden, which is kind of very interesting. We live in a rectilinear world, meaning we live in houses that are rectangles, or and we live in rooms that are rectangles. So we grow up with 90 degree corners, and we're comfortable with 90 degree corners, right? Now I can go off and tell you about my times in Africa, but I don't want to go there today because there's too much to talk about.
Okay.
But round buildings, or round spaces are kind of like a sea change in how we understand space. And you have to be very careful designing round spaces simply because people don't resonate
Right,
with
right, right.
it.
Yeah,
You understand?
I do.
And
I do.
but circles, of course, what circles do when you get more than five people together and you're all talking, you automatically arrange yourself in a circle
Right.
without even thinking, right? If it's more than five people,
Right.
you stand around a circle. So you don't stand around a square,
I know. That's funny. That's
Yeah,
good.
but so circles do establish communion of sorts and community, and they
Absolutely.
should definitely be used more.
They're more welcoming, Yeah.
They're
And
softer.
I love what you talk about in walls, patios, walks, and steps. Edging makes a difference.
That's a little detail that I use all the time, edging. And it's details. So, like, if you have a real small little space, and I mean really tiny, what is important? It's the details. It's the details that become important. The quality of the plant, you know, the color of the rose, the kind of surface, paving or gravel or whatever it is that you might have. All of a sudden, those things become very, very important. And I use details like a little bit of stone edging between the patio and the plants. You know, it helps with maintenance, but it also adds a little kind of nice touch. So, and there's all different kinds of edging that you can use, depending on what your materials are. A lot of times I'll take whatever paving stone that we're using, and that could be different in different parts of the country, and I set it upright. So that now I have it a step go 2 to 2.5 inches above the terrace, as an edging to a bed or a to a to whatever.
It dresses it up, right?
There you go. That's a nice way to say that.
And I love the idea of you telling people when you create a patio, make sure you have enough space, right? And not just space to pull the chair out to sit at the table or to walk around, but space so that it fits properly in the rest of the garden, right?
Oh my goodness. Have you, I don't know if you've seen, I've seen it so many times where they'll put in a beautiful patio or whatever, and then they go buy the furniture or get, and then they bring the furniture back and there's no room.
Oops.
I mean, like high design areas, you know, because they just didn't realize that if you have table and chairs, you got to pull the chair out. So you, it's not just the chair that you need space for, it's the chair and people pulling it out.
You should label that, the carpentry rule. As a rule, sorry, measure twice, cut once.
Yeah, that's right. We should do that.
We should do that. Measure twice, cut once.
And I mean, you know, if you listen, if you hear us talk about all these little tips I share with people, you say, well, that's common sense. Yeah, it is common sense, but for some reason, it goes out the window.
It's got it. The excitement of probably how it'll look and, to have that new thing, I understand that.
Yeah.
I love your idea of a cap on a wall.
Oh.
Not that doesn't happen that often.
And you know, I mean, I know that again, that goes into the detail thing that we talk about, but when you say stone wall to somebody or brick wall, whatever, they don't think about the top of it too much. And if you put a horizontal piece of stone, you know, nice, smooth surface stone as a little cap with a little bit of an overhang, all of a sudden you have a bench. Or you have, right? Or you have a place where you could put the glass of iced tea. You know, all of a sudden it's multifunctional just by that little addition.
It's and not that much additional expense, right?
That's right. I mean, if you're building the wall, consider doing a 1.5 inch capstone on top.
So, in your themed garden design section, what's your favorite topic? Kitchen gardens, crevice gardens, whimsy?
Oh, of all the themed gardens that I share?
Yes. What's your
Oh,
favorite one?
well, that is a great question.
I like crevice gardens. They're sort of being introduced out here because of their value.
Crevice gardens, for gardeners, crevice gardens are quite exciting, don't you think?
Oh, I love them. It's just a whole nother approach. And in addition to accenting a whole garden.
I think that's got to be one of my favorites too, the crevice garden. And I know people, you probably where you are have a lot of beautiful rocks and things like that.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
So that they can kind of fashion it in a way that there are spaces in between.
And I had a talk with the director of Plant Select, Ross Schreigli, and he talked about, we have Firewise, and the first 5 feet away from the house has gravel or nothing in it, or right at the edge you can put some plants that are, not as or more fire resistant. And so crevice gardens are a wonderful sort of stopgap in those sections.
Makes ultimate sense, yeah, with what you're describing. That brings up the fact that even though my book, I have all these pictures of northeastern beautiful lush gardens, the tips relate to everybody, which, because I take photos of where I live, but like when I talk about the tip that talks about become a connoisseur of stone walls, and I talk about how, people, you go to a gallery or something and everybody sits and stares at the paintings on the wall. And I'm saying, well, we've got stone walls that people could become connoisseurs of. He's like, look at this wall versus that kind of wall. I mean, it's because they're all artists that build these walls, masons. So even though I talk about the walls that I see where I live, it relates right to anywhere. Right, don't, so I want to, even though I don't want people to say, oh, look, this is all Northeastern gardens. No, the tips relate to everyone.
Oh no, these are basic tips that would align with any garden anywhere.
Yeah,
Anywhere. Absolutely.
that's,
And
yeah.
in your section on color, you say nothing affects us as strongly as color in the garden. Why is that?
Oh boy, that's a great, okay, so when I give my PowerPoint, I have a great PowerPoint that goes along with this, and we're talking about structure and we're talking about shape and we're talking about all this fun stuff. But then I show a very colorful garden, and I said, "Are you looking at the structure? Are you looking at the shape?" No, you're looking at the color. And as you probably know, scientists have determined that we see color before we see anything else, before we see shape or shadow or height or. We see color. That's the first thing. I mean, that's why people wear those colorful dresses. And so once you understand how powerful color is in our psyche, and from a healing perspective and everything else, that you have to be a little mindful of what colors you're going to surround yourself with.
Absolutely. There was 1 year in New York when I lived there, that I didn't know what to plant off the front patio area. And I said, oh, whatever, I'll just go to the nursery. And I got all these annuals, all different colors. And I just plopped them in the ground and said, well, let's see what this does. It was this huge mosaic. And you couldn't see it. This is your hide and reveal. You'd have to come up the driveway, and as you got near the top of the driveway, you could see this massive color. And people would stop and go, oh, wow.
Right?
I had so much fun with that. It was so easy. It was just like, just plunk down all these annuals and all these different colors, and it just came out better than I expected it actually.
I ask people, this is so when I give my talks and I ask people what their favorite colors are, and do you know the most popular color, bar none, and I've read about it, but in all my talks, I find it's true. Male and female alike is blue. And how does that translate to gardening? Everybody wants a blue garden,
I know.
right? Blue, 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 blue. And I say, well, blue is recessive. Blue is a shy color, right? It kind of disappears. And I said, if you love blue, you got to push it to the front. You got to push it to the front of the bed, right? Because it's like a little shy little kid, you got to push him in the front. Because otherwise, you're not going to see it. So those are the tips I share.
Do you remember there was a lobelia plant
Oh, yeah.
for edging, Crystal Palace, I
Crystal
believe
Palace.
it.
Yep.
And I used it in the containers at Salisbury State 1 year under the pergola. And it had just been introduced. And I thought, I'll buy the seed. My
I
students.
remember when it was introduced way back when, like in the 80s, I
And
think.
And so my students grew it, and we put these big baskets of blue lobelia, Crystal Palace, and we hung them out there. And the local nurseries and greenhouses didn't order it in, didn't have it. And so they were calling us, and people were demanding that plant, and they were calling me, and I'm going, well, I think it was Park Seed that sold it. And I said, well, you'll have to order it next year because I'm sorry, And they
Wow.
did. And they did. But oh my gosh, talk about driving the local market.
Wow, that is fascinating. And it's a blue flower. I want the blue flower, right?
And
Exactly.
it was cool enough, long enough there that it lasted a good long time. And then we change it out with something else. But that I never it never dawned on me, but it just caught my eye, and it was new and exciting and fun, and it's fun for the students to grow it on, and so we did it.
Well, you know what? The other thing that I always talk about when it comes to color is and I, you know, I well, I'll tell you a little bit, not one more story, but it's called the pop of red. That's what I call pop of red. And famous artists do that, like Norman Rockwell. If you ever look at any Norman Rockwell paintings, he always has the pop of red. It's like when my son was young, I used to play a game with him and say, "Find the pop of red." You know, we were at the Norman Rockwell Museum, and he had to go to every painting and find the pop of red or every drawing. And so it's the same thing in a garden. It's like if you just get a hybrid begonia or whatever you want to get, you know, anything red, you know, it just livens up the whole place.
Wow. So in your last section, plants and planting,
Yeah.
why do we plant?
Why do we plant? Why do we want to plant, or right? Why?
Yeah, why at all?
Oh, well, as I feel that we're a part of nature and that we have developed over the eons in association with plants. I feel that the plants are our fellow companions on this plane, if I don't get too out there.
Oh
I
no.
just feel we need to be near plants for our well-being and our
Absolutely.
health and our well-being. And more they're talking to us about that. But I think it's much more important than what they're saying, oh, have a view of a tree out your window. No, I feel like we need to be near plants. Which, of course, societies go in the opposite direction. I mean, no, we don't want to put plants within an urban environment. We want to put buildings within a plant environment.
Well, that's the way it should be, right?
Right?
Yes. Yeah.
And it's not just because they're pretty, it's for our sustenance, mentally and physically.
Absolutely. And I love the way that you use plants as as a visible edge. You know, yes, you can use stone, you can use gravel, you can use whatever, but plants, you
Yes.
know, can really enhance the rest of what you have in that bed.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I always say people tend to say, oh, less is more, you know, one of those minimal approaches. And I have a tip there's called more is more, meaning
I
that
read that. I love that. Oh my
just
gosh.
like go ahead, just go crazy. Who
I know.
cares? You know, everybody, again, it goes back to people wanting rules. I said, nah, don't. It's like you with the annuals. Just, you know, you saw that plant you love, just pop it in there. You know,
Exactly.
he'll love being with all the others.
Yes. So
So,
do you have any favorite plants that you like using in your designs?
yes, I do. But I don't know if they grow where you grow, so I can talk about several. In my lush area where I live in Northeast United States, my favorite is a native called oak leaf hydrangea. And
Yeah.
it is a magnificent plant, and the flowers stay on the shrub. They get darker as the season progresses. It's not like the flowers show up and then they turn to fruit and die. No. These flowers stay on the plant. So as it gets colder, the plant changes. It's just so satisfying. But so that's that one plant. But no, other thing, other plants that I just have so much fun with nowadays are sedums, stonecrops.
Yep.
There's so many.
Some some are hardy out here, some are not hardy. So we have to be careful, but yes, there's a wider variety.
So I mean, that's like, if you have just a little bit of space or a little pot or whatever, and you don't want to be married to your to upkeep, I find that sedums are really quite satisfying, and so many varieties.
And can be used so in so many ways, in so many situations in a garden design.
Absolutely, right? They can be used as a ground cover, or they can be used as an accent plant. You got a
Exactly.
big, tall, growing, sedum
Right.
madrona, or you can have the sedum angelina as a ground cover, whatever. It's just, you can do a whole sedum garden and your crevice garden too.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
So I
Well,
think that those should be better known.
can you give a couple minutes to your one of your other books
Yes,
called
thank you.
The Spirit of Stones? Is it? Is that correct?
The Spirit of Stone,
The Spirit of Stone.
101 Practical and Creative Stonescaping Ideas for Your Garden. And
Perfect book for out here. Perfect
oh
book.
yeah, and I should probably send you that,
Please.
because and we should talk again perhaps,
Yes.
because I talk all about using natural stone in the landscape, like stone stepping paths or stone walls, or dry stack, the different kinds of stone walls. And it's like, here's one, 10 tips for building a freestanding dry stone wall. And this has become quite a popular book, because it's just talking about like gravel gardens, different kinds of stone paving. But in plants, oh, look at this, plants that grow in the cracks and crevices of walls and stones. I mean, there you go, right?
Oh, cool. Yeah.
So yeah, and so it's a little book, it's not too big, and it's quite popular.
Cool. Wonderful.
And another book I have is called Heaven is a Garden, and that one is like my passion project. And I talk about the magic of water and the myth messages of trees. It's a little off the charts, but I think you would enjoy it.
I absolutely would,
Heaven is a
yeah.
garden.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All
So
right.
thank you for that.
Well, Jan, thank you for joining me today.
Oh, I have enjoyed this conversation immensely, really.
It's been wonderful.
And can
And
I just share that I post every day on Instagram?
oh, sure. Go ahead. Go ahead. Give them your Instagram address.
Okay, so my Instagram address is at Johnsen Design, and that's Johnsen, Johnsen Design, one whole word,
Wow.
at Johnsen Design. And every single day I post something. And then I also have a Substack. A Substack is a platform that people, and I write all my posts for free and paid subscribers. And I try to do it twice a week, but sometimes I don't get to it. But my Substack is called Gardentopia, just like the book, Gardentopia. It's
Oh,
on
good.
Substack.
Good to know. Thanks for sharing that. Okay.
Thank you for letting me. Yes.
Yeah, sure. And a thank you to the audience for listening. Tune in next time when we get to the heart of the matter of another horticultural topic.